there's such power in kind of using this wise adult self to offer this compassion, care, validation, and perhaps even new perspective to our younger selves.
Welcome to LoveLink, your guide to love and sex in all forms. We are your hosts, Simone Humphrey and Sina Simon. Today, we welcome Adam Cohen, a licensed psychotherapist with a practice in the Bay Area devoted to LGBTQ+ adolescents and adults. He developed Second Adolescence as a conceptual framework for healing and liberating from the trauma of growing up queer in an anti-queer world. Cohen is the host of the podcast Second Adolescence and author of his upcoming book, Second Adolescence. We're so excited to have him on our pod. So welcome to LoveLink, Adam. It's so nice to have you here with us.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here and curious to be here and yeah, feel really honored.
So first and foremost, I love your new podcast, Second Adolescence. So great. So interesting. I love these different stories that you've been integrating into every episode, really getting into people's experience of what Second Adolescence is. I know you also are in the midst of writing a book, maybe it's done, but not out yet, around Second Adolescence. So you're doing all of this work on this topic. Tell us a little bit about what Second Adolescence is.
Oh, yeah, I will. Thank you. And again, I could talk about this for hours, so I'm going to try to be as succinct as I can. But so, because I think Second Adolescence is such an important part of so many queer people's stories, and we're not really talking a ton about kind of what this experience is like. And I guess before going anywhere, let me just a note on languaging. I'm going to be using that word queer throughout this conversation and really using it as an umbrella term for identities that fall within the LGBTQ+ spectrum, kind of non-cisgendered heterosexual identities. So I'll be using queer to kind of be this collective, kind of expansive, inclusive term for the greater community. And yes, I mean, I guess like when we think about typically queer stories, we give a lot of curiosity and focus to what's it like for the queer person growing up and in the closet, and then what's it like for them going through the whole coming out process. And all of that is so important. And it's also important to really ask, like, well, what happens on the other side of that? Like, what's the impact of growing up in the way queer people grow up? And how does that impact them when they are on that other side of coming out, trying to find themselves? And so like starting there, yeah, it can be really common for queer people at that point on the other side of coming out when they're trying to find themselves as their full queer self and perhaps start pursuing dating, sex, and relationships for the first time, they can often feel like teenagers as they're having this experience. You know, they feel awkward and insecure and intoxication and confusion and exhilaration, feel feelings that they don't know how to feel and how to make sense of and what they're feeling. And this was absolutely part of my story too. I was 25 when I started dating men, but absolutely felt like this fumbling 13-year-old trying to navigate dating and relationships for the first time, because in many ways, I still was that 13-year-old. In many ways, queer people who feel this teenage self on the other side of coming out are still that younger self, because of how we experience adolescence, there is often this stunting of different parts of self that can occur and this freezing in developmental time. I mean, like thinking about adolescence, it's perhaps the most important life stage we humans grow through with regards to the development of the self and identity and how we see ourselves in relation to others. Like so much psychosocial development is available at that age, and there's so much potential for that unless something gets in the way, which for queer people growing up within this anti-queer world, there are a lot of interruptions to having access to that potential that adolescence offers. And so we often have a different experience in adolescence than our cisgendered straight peers have access to. We often have a different experience of that adolescence, you know, this adolescence where you get to start gaining those firsts of romantic and like dating experiences, right? Like having your first crushes and being able to share those with your friends, like having failed attempts at flirting and learning how it feels to get rejected, and having those first relationships, first kisses, first handholds, first time bringing partners into family and friends, first sexual experiences, like all of these firsts that our peers were getting to start having in middle school, high school, into college, many queer people don't get to start experiencing until sometime later. And so we have an adolescent marked by really missing out on a ton. But what also complicates our experience in adolescence, makes it different than our cis straight peers, their experience of adolescence is we're going through the, you know, the normal trials and tribulations of adolescence, which, mind you, it's like challenging for anybody, like even the most privileged, it's rare for them to get through adolescence unscathed. And so queer people have that this added challenge of navigating this already pretty tumultuous time, all the while also dealing with, often unconsciously, the impacts of this chronic shame that we kind of have with us since the beginning of kind of our upbringing, right? Like, we are socialized within this world where we are exposed to this onslaught of indirect and direct messaging about the wrongness of queerness, the differentness of queerness, the sinfulness of queerness, like these day in, day out, year after year, comments either made by family and friends or community leaders, like in our microculture, or messaging we receive kind of just witnessing the macro culture, like representation or lack thereof of queerness in the media, anti-queer legislation, like all of that for these younger queer people, like it's sending us messages that are teaching us to only feel shame and fear for this part of ourselves. And each time we experience one of those messages, it seems to kind of add another layer of shame and fear onto us, further infecting kind of how we come to see ourselves and our place in this world and all of that. And so all of that to say, like going back to this idea of second adolescence, it's really about the reckoning of that. You know, if we're working with like a working definition of second adolescence, I conceptualize it as this developmental life stage queer adults have to grow through after navigating our first adolescence in this anti-queer world. And everyone's second adolescence is going to look a little different, but we have to tend to those experiences in our first adolescence of kind of reckon with these experiences that we missed out on. And we have to address the wounds that our younger selves accrued, namely that of chronic shame. So, yeah, I mean, that's what I'm thinking about in terms of second adolescence. Yeah.
What a beautiful definition. And I thought you defined it so well. And all of these layers that happen, the excitement and the joy, the grief of that first adolescence, the shame that's kind of trickled throughout. Yeah. And I love that you put a term to that, because I imagine so many people feel very alone in that experience. And even just naming it allows people to feel more connected to this stage. Mm, yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I was thinking about how important it is to feel okay about entering into a second adolescence and to really allow for that experience. And I imagine that some shame could be evoked in even having those feelings come up so strongly as an adult. Yes. Like, what's going on? This is very confusing. Like Simone, you were saying, a real like loneliness that could exist there. And I was curious to hear a little bit about your experience and maybe some of your patients' experiences of being both an adult and an adolescent at the same time, because I imagine there are parts of self, you know, when you're 25 that are adult, you know, right. And then there are parts of self that are still in this exploratory novel phase, right? And how you kind of negotiate those two parts of yourself.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really appreciate you naming that. Like, there is such a shame that can come from feeling that dissonance. Like, wait, I am this 25-year-old, this 35-year-old, this 45-year-old who is, I should know how to go on a date. I should know how to be in a relationship. I should. All of these shoulds get created because we're seeing our peers, our straight peers at the same age. They're doing it. They've been doing it and they seem to be doing it quite well. But it's really important for queer people who kind of are in the second adolescence journey, who didn't get an adolescence like other people around them had, didn't get to start having these experiences until later, to really create space to have some compassion for, hey, here's why I feel this underdevelopment inside. Here's why I feel this teenage self inside. That's that theme of kind of needing to have compassion for our younger selves shows up in all of my work with clients. It's come up a ton in the podcast where I'm interviewing other people about their experience. And yeah, absolutely has been part of my own journey. I mean, I guess I'll share a little bit about my second adolescence if that's interesting or
We'd
helpful.
We'd love that. Yeah, okay. Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, so yeah, my second adolescence really started at 25. That was kind of on the tail end of my gradual coming out, which would be a whole other conversation. But eventually I got to this place at 25 where I was finally ready to start living fully in my queerness and trying to start dating for the first time. And I was starting to have some of these experiences that were so exciting and exhilarating and nerve-wracking. And at the same time, I was feeling a lot of that shame. Like, why is this so weird for me? Why can't I just act normal? This is making me think of another concept I talk a lot about with folks, is this idea of the necessaries of the beginning of dating and relationships. I think of these as these like necessary but messy experiences that we grow through in order to grow our relational, sexual, and romantic selves. Like, I guess even for you both, thinking back to whenever it was that you started dating and navigating relationships, I imagine there's these moments where you look back upon them and like cringe at your younger self. Like, oh, why did I do that? Right? Totally. Absolutely. And so I think it's like really important to like acknowledge like, well, yeah, we didn't know what we were doing. And so for queer people, they're having a lot of their necessaries in adulthood. And it's supposed to be new and uncomfortable. We don't know what we're doing because we don't have that lived experience, that embodied experience of what it feels like to be in these certain situations. And so I really invite people to approach their necessaries, to approach kind of that beginning phase of growing their romantic and sexual selves with a lot of compassion. Because again, like the way we experienced adolescence, so many of us queer people, either consciously or unconsciously, shut off our romantic and sexual selves. We put them away. We don't give them space to grow. And we really disconnect them from how we really experience our full self concept. And so much of that second adolescence experience is really about learning how to both grow these parts of self that we didn't let grow before and integrate them into how we experience ourselves and how we see ourselves. And all of that eventually leads the queer person just to feel more comfort going through these situations, being in these romantic and sexual dynamics, knowing how to feel and how to communicate and how to navigate, like all these things that of course we didn't know at the beginning, we gradually learn to as time goes on.
Yeah. I work with several clients who are at different stages of coming out. And I'm wondering whether in your experience or your experience helping others, like how to work with clients who want to come out but still hold on to the shame that really holds them back from kind of fully being in touch with themselves in this way.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, so there's so many different ways to kind of work with shame. But how I work with the shame that is related to queerness, I generally have a goal with clients is to help them bring more awareness to the how and when that shame first got imprinted onto them and reinforced and how that's showing up for them now and particularly how it's getting in their way. And so like what that looks like is going back through their stories and guiding them through their stories of growing up in childhood and adolescence and looking for opportunities to kind of pause them and invite them just to have more space and curiosity to understand like what was that younger version of them being exposed to with regards to messaging around queerness and gender norms and all of that. And then I do a ton of younger self work in my work with clients, really drawing a lot of influence from internal family systems, parts work, inner child work. And so I'll also like, as we're kind of going back in their story and kind of identifying the different points where a shame belief and a shame message was kind of transmitted to them, I'll pause them and really invite the client just to start to think about what's it like for them to think about this younger version of them coming to learn this about themselves. Like, I think there's such a need. I think the ultimate task of queer healing is really healing the wounds of our younger selves. And so I find there's such a power in increasing our clients' relationship to these different younger selves. And there's such power in kind of using this wise adult self to offer this compassion, care, validation, and perhaps even new perspective to our younger selves. And so with shame, I'll kind of invite them to really engage with their younger selves who are starting to learn this about themselves and to see kind of what happens. Like oftentimes that can be a place where so much healing is occurring with them, perhaps even dialoguing with their younger self or kind of communicating what the younger self was feeling that maybe the younger self was not able to communicate at a certain point. And so like really working with shame within that younger self relationship, as well as helping the client. I'm the narrative therapist in me loves to really externalize shame and homophobia as these entities that are showing up like in the client's past, but also presently for them to really start to recognize when it's shame that's in the driver's seat, what homophobia is telling them. And so maybe in session, I might model that first, like, gosh, so it really sounds like shame was telling 14-year-old you it wasn't okay to have the feelings she was having for her best friend. And then kind of see if that can eventually lead the client to start to be able to use that themselves. And they'll come in like, oh, shame totally tried to hijack my date. I like wanted to kiss her outside, but shame told me that everyone was going to be looking. Like, so like that type of relationship to these inner belief systems. Again, I want to help the client externalize their self from the shame. When we can kind of create more space between the client and shame, that also can create more space to find and really elevate the part of them that's really wanting something different and seeing kind of what that part has to say. Why do they want to come out? Just basically trying to illuminate for the client, like all the different layers here, like what their resistance is saying and what the part of them that's wanting to see change is saying. And then also, I mean, with regards to coming out, there also is this need to also address this concept of safety, like how safe is it for them to come out in whatever their context is, right? Like assessing, is there a financial threat to coming out? Is there a housing or economic threat to coming out? Like depending on what's going on for them in their context, there might be a need to kind of safety plan around coming out if and when they do decide that's what they're wanting.
And I hear you as you're talking about all these different themes related to that can evoke shame, just really validating for patients, you know, their experience of all this pressure. Like I hear all this pressure on queer adolescents, like, you know, pressure to think about safety around coming out, you know, am I gonna be okay in my family, et cetera, you know, just the idea of coming out in itself is a huge pressure that straight people don't have to contend with. I mean, Simone and I were talking about, you know, the coming out process is being then you're sexualized in front of your parents, right? Like straight people don't have to go through that experience either.
Right.
You know, and at a young age when you're already feeling awkward and weird and uncomfortable with sexuality, then I don't know, there's just a lot of pressure.
And that there's this expectation that it's such a formalized process, you know, that for some people that may not be the process that they want, but there's a real expectation. If you're queer, then there should be this big coming out. And I mean, even, yeah, I think within queer communities, there's this like, what's your coming out story? And so I think like, even though in some ways that can be a really important and maybe healing moment, I think for some people, that added pressure really kind of can be quite harmful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just gets in the way. Just gets in the way. Totally. And so that's another piece to really kind of try to detangle for our clients is what is the pressure they're feeling, pressure they're either projecting from the outside, what's happening kind of internally. Yeah, because that's just another thing they don't need to have to be dealing with, right?
Yeah.
It's so hard.
Yeah. But I love the way that you work to separate themselves from the shame. You know, shame is so consuming and it really can be so sticky that it's hard to even know what's you versus the shame. And I think being able to either talk to the younger part and really leaning more into the non-shameful part, into the part that's saying it's okay to be who you are, is such a helpful way of just kind of disentangling that.
Thank you. And it's so cool to witness. I'm sure you've kind of had similar experiences with clients, just kind of when that detangling can occur, like there's so much more space for the person to really find out like, well, what's most true for me? What do I want? And how do I go get that? How do I start living from that place? And like part of like, it's also, I also love to give a lot of love to shame because like, in a way, like it's been there as like a protective mechanism, like the part of shame that's there to like, hey, stay quiet. Like, it's not safe. Like it wasn't safe. Like there's sometimes for clients, I mean, let me back it up. Let's not give a ton of love to shame, but like the protective function of shame, sometimes in that work with younger selves, there can be a real need to acknowledge like, hey, that this is why the shame was created. And though painful, it also was in a way serving a function there, because sometimes we have shame for having shame and it's just like, it's very messy. So sometimes some more space can get created and we can also bring in like this other opinion about kind of the function of shame.
I'm curious what it was like for you in your first adolescence, watching other teenagers have these experiences that you weren't having. Like, were you aware of missing out on experiences? I'm curious how that impacted you to witness.
Yeah, it sucked. I was very aware. I was, you know, not every queer person in the closet in adolescence is there consciously. Like, it can be the experience for some folks where they're not aware fully of their queerness. They just have this general sense of differentness and otherness. They don't know really why, but that still does create a barrier from them to other people, and they are not pursuing dating, and they're not kind of doing different things that their peers are doing. But for me, I had the experience where I was very much aware of this queerness that was kind of growing within me and wouldn't stop growing. And I knew that I couldn't act from that. And so I tried to do what a lot of queer people in the closet do. I tried to see, oh, can I change this? So I really leaned into trying to pass as a straight boy, using a different passing strategies to have other people, one, not see this part of me that I was really scared of, but also just to try to, in hopes that maybe this would quote unquote change me, it would get rid of this queerness, which is so complicated in itself. But yeah, and so I was going through the motions. I even had some girlfriends in middle school and high school, but it wasn't at all the same, and I knew it. And I feel like this interesting thing can happen for queer people in the closet, is we can almost like split like realities. Like, there's like the real world, then there's this fantasy world. So in like the real world, I'm showing up as this straight perceived person. I'm going through the motions. I might even have a girlfriend, but then there's this fantasy world where I really like my true feelings are there, where I would just dream at night and daydream in class, like of finding like the boy one day who would kind of save me from the loneliness. Cause it's lonely when you're in the closet. It's a lonely place to be. You feel like no one understands you, because they don't. You're still trying to understand yourself. And so I definitely had a huge part of me that was really wishing that I could have this like love that I saw my friends getting to have, having these sexual experiences that my friends were getting to have. I at this age was really wanting to have those experiences with different boys at my school, but I couldn't. And so there was a real longing. Like, longing is a word that I so identify with throughout like high school into college. Like, before coming out, longing was such a big part of my experience, just really hoping that one day. But it also felt so impossible to get to that point in longing. And that's like this longing and this kind of hoping for one day and missing out on these experiences. It kind of ties into a lot of my own personal work, but also a lot of work I see with clients, is this need to grieve that time period when we're longing or not getting what we needed, really grieve this missed adolescence. Like, there's such a loss for queer people who don't come out until later in life. Even queer people who come out in adolescence, like, oftentimes they're not having that easy of a time. And so there's a loss of this adolescence we wish we could have had. And it's so deeply important to create space to allow for that grief to come up, because I think a lot of queer people are navigating life with a lot of unprocessed grief for this beginning phase of their own lives that never was and they wish could have been. And that was absolutely part of my story too.
That makes sense. Because adolescence is like, for a lot of people, is like kind of wild and feels a little insane and expansive and scary. And what I hear you talking about is like getting more rigid, getting more contained, like trying to perform something, you know, kind of the opposite in a way of what other adolescents were probably doing.
Absolutely. It wasn't safe for us to be fully free, right? And so I think queer people in the closet, like, even if we're going through the motions and having some like adolescent experiences, quote unquote, we're always still like kind of having one eye open, kind of one foot out, assessing constantly, like, is everyone here? Do they have a sense that I am gay? Or am I going to do or say something that's going to expose the secret? Like, you're constantly in this like state of like anxious monitoring of self. So you're not able to just kind of be, you're not able to experience what it feels like to be free and to be wild. And that's why, yeah, again, in a lot of people's second adolescences, there can be more of that exciting wildness for the first time and liberation. Right. Yeah.
Right. Maybe even more so because you've had all of this exhausting time where you've been hiding, you've been scanning, you've been just like expending all this energy.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hi, LoveLink listeners. Our group practice, Modern Mind, is located in New York City with offices in Brooklyn and Manhattan, offering in-person and virtual psychotherapy.
We provide individual, couples, and group therapy, as well as ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, in conjunction with a psychiatry prescriber. Therapy is a powerful experience that can transform your life and help you live it to its full potential. We're here to help take you where you want to go. To find out more about our practice, visit www.modernmind.co or email info@modernmind.co to be connected with one of our therapists.
So what was your process like coming out? You said it was a kind of slow coming out. What did that look like?
Yeah. This is a thing that I've talked with clients a lot about, or I hear from clients a lot. We almost think like, okay, once we come out, everything will change and it'll be just one easy conversation. It's just this one act coming out. And it's so common for queer people to have such a long drawn out coming out. It's not just a one and done thing. Even today, where a lot of people use the internet to come out in like a social media post, like, yes, that takes up a lot of space, but there's still kind of other parts of coming out that have to follow that as well or precede that. So for me, it was kind of scattered again through these ages of 21 to 25. I hit a wall in college. So my junior year of college, where I was just really feeling so much sorrow and frustration that I was not, again, getting to have these experiences I saw my peers having. I really felt like I wasn't fully living. I was like really wanting to be in a relationship. I was really wanting to hook up. I was really wanting all these things that my peers in college were having. And I still felt too afraid and I still didn't want to let people know this part of me. But it also just like, it started like really irking me. I felt like, God, it's already been 21 years of my life. Like, what the heck, Adam, we got to start at some point. And I think like, I just had this vision. I just hoped that someone, I wouldn't have to come out. Someone would just like, a guy would just come find me. We start dating and I could just be like, oh yeah, like I'm dating someone. It's a boy. But like, how are they going to find you, Adam, when you're high, like you're still masking, you're still like not going to queer spaces. Like it was, I have a lot of compassion for my little 21-year-old or 20-year-old self who was like hoping things would change magically. Like I'd run into the person in the coffee shop, like that whole thing. But anyway, so reached a point where I wanted things to change. And so I kind of told who was my last girlfriend in high school. She was the first person I told. And that like absolutely changed the game for me, because though it was so scary to tell her, it then led to this 3-hour conversation where I got to, for the very first time at 21, have this experience of being able to be fully seen by the person I'm with. Like in that moment, I realized like, oh, wow, all of the friendships and even family relationships I'd had up until then, I was never a full participant in that experience. When we're in the closet, there is a deep barrier between us and everyone else around us. It's unsafe to really let people in, even our family all the way in. And so I had this like amazing conversation with a friend for the first time. Like it might be the greatest drug in the world, getting to just be your true self with someone. And I never had that until that moment. And so I had that, but I was also, you know, the next day I like woke up with like such the emotional hangover of like, why did I do that? This is so scary. Like she's going to tell everyone. The shame and fear were very active still. And they remained very active still. And for over the next 4 years, like that became such my work of needing to keep slowly tackling the shame and fear. But there was like a period of like stagnation when I was like 22, 23. I didn't tell anyone else. I'd only told her and another close friend. Then eventually like hit a wall again. I was like, I need to start living. And so again, it's not a quick one and done. It was like one step forward, 3 steps back, 4 steps forward. That was very much my coming out. So then I told my family finally, which was like, again, just so wild and so weird to be talking with people you've known your whole life, but now you feel like you're talking with them for the first time, and uncomfortable, but so beautiful at the same time. And then gradually, yeah, it's more coming out more and more. And eventually kind of hitting this wall at 25, where I was like, okay, where I was living in Santa Barbara at the time after college, that's where I went to college. And it wasn't that queer of a city. I wanted to start dating. I still hadn't been on a date. I was 25, still hadn't gone on a date with a guy. I wanted that. And so I decided to shift gears. I moved to San Francisco. Then I leaned in and second adolescence began at that point. But yeah, that's kind of a synopsis of the coming out journey, which again, it's not always a simple here's the one thing that happened when I came out. It's a long process for folks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It sounds difficult. It also sounds really beautiful and moving. Mm-hmm. And no better place to have a second adolescence than in San Francisco. I mean,
mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's been like a common theme on the podcast with people and their stories, is like this idea of needing to leave wherever home is, to go to wherever they can find a nearby queer space and city. It's a little different now. Luckily, like the internet has totally changed the game in terms of access to queer community and queer education and all of it. But for many people in like the millennial generation and older, like there was often this migration to places where we felt like we could find community for the first time. And for me in my own journey, I needed, because my shame and fear was so strong, I needed to be living within an environment that just allowed for queerness just to be there from the get-go. And so I have such a deep love for San Francisco and what it's offered me in my journey. And that's a comment with a lot of my clients who live in San Francisco, like there's definitely that shared experience. And that being said, of course, it's not accessible to everyone to be able to move. It's not accessible for everyone to be able to find a queer community in real life. Again, that's why I'm really grateful for the internet. I mean, lots of problems with the internet, but it's opened up the doors for folks to find people and to find community. And for queer people, it is absolutely necessary.
Right. I was going to ask if you think it's gotten easier now for queer youth to identify themselves as queer and to, you know, explore their identity more. But then I was like, you know, I think, so we have a family friend who's actually, it's in Copenhagen where my family is, and they have an 8-year-old who's already identifies as queer, and totally, you know, their parents are very supportive, the school is very supportive, friends, you know. And, but then I'm like, wait, but this is, he's living in a city in Copenhagen, in the capital, it's super liberal. Mm-hmm. And we live in New York, same kind of cultural environment for the most part. Yeah. And so I don't know if my perception is actually skewed on that. Like my assumption is, yeah, it's easier, but I don't know that that's true. But I was curious to hear from you what you think about that.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of think two things are true. I think like we've seen a ton of progress in terms of the expansion of our awareness and celebration of and acceptance of queerness. And we still very much live in a heteronormative world, and queerness is still very much an oppressed experience. Like on the former, like I do think things are different for queer youth today. Like just looking at the media, we have such, you know, everything from queer YouTubers telling their story to like queer content in like graphic novels and film, TV. There has been such a great influx of diverse representation of queerness that our young people today have more access to be able to see other people that reflect their experience and give them language to describe their experience. And also like the culture has shifted where queerness is becoming a bit more integrated into the fabric of our culture. That being said, like, I think like anti-queerness rhetoric has always been there. And with this continued increasing of the polarization politically, now I'm thinking kind of particularly in our country, like it's also added so much fuel to the fire of anti-queerness on the side that is really preaching that. And so like it still is not a safe place for queer people across the board. I mean, just look at all the anti-queer legislation that's happening even this past year. And yeah, like even in San Francisco where I live and work, I have queer adolescent clients who are being bullied at school for being queer. I have queer adolescents clients who have homophobic family members within their home. Like, so even in San Francisco, like one of the queerest cities, it still is there. Yeah, I mean, I think things have changed, but I also think that a lot of queer youth today in their adolescence today are probably going to need some form of second adolescence. And that's only going to change when we finally have a culture that allows queer youth to like fully be able to experience adolescence in the way they should.
Yeah, it's so deeply embedded. It's so deep in our history. And so even in these places that are much more accepting, like you said, it's really insidious. And sometimes it's overt. And then sometimes it's these real like microaggressions that are even hard to even put our finger on, which can make it very confusing, I think, probably for a young person, where it's like, on the surface, everything seems acceptable. They should be able to embrace their identity. And yet there's still these feelings that are still there, which I think probably creates a whole different type of psychology around that. And then I think also, yeah, the point around this real backlash that's happening in our country, mm-hmm. where it's like mm-hmm. we've reached this point that seems so progressive. And yet all of this kind of anti-queer legislation, like the Don't Say Gay in Florida, like it's shocking. It's like it really feels, it's so disheartening too.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And it makes it really hard, particularly when I'm working with younger queer people on their own relationship to queerness and working through their shame that they're currently in. It's really hard to really fully remove that shame when they're very much in this world where they're seeing so much anti-queerness thrown at them that at such a loud volume. It was almost easier in some ways, like 5-10 years ago, because it was, as you're speaking to, a little bit more covert or a little bit more microaggressions. It just wasn't as loud and as harmful. So it's a very difficult time, despite it also at the same time being a time where so much has changed.
How much do you bring yourself into the room with your clients? Because I'm also imagining like some of the shared experiences, especially with legislation and politics. Like, yeah, what's your use of self in the room with a client who is really struggling with their queerness and you may relate or have your own experience?
Yeah, great question. I'm thinking that from the beginning of my career, it's been, of course, an evolution for me in terms of, you know, in our training, we're often taught to be very sensitive to only self-disclosing when it feels in service of the client and their work and not meeting our needs. And I feel like it's been a growing comfort for me to both feel more comfortable self-disclosing, engaging when it feels appropriate. And with queer people, I probably self-disclose with queer clients more than I do with non-queer clients. And that looks a little bit different for each person. And so I have a lot of people that I work with in that first initial consult call. It's very important for them to have a queer therapist. And so they'll ask and I'll answer and then explore with them why that feels important for them or not. And then throughout kind of the work together, there might be different moments where they're talking about an experience and they're feeling really, really alone in it. And I'd say more often than not, what I do to self-disclose while also keeping a lot of the focus on the client's experience and also trying to connect them to this greater queer experience is I use a lot of us and we language. And so if, say, they're processing this idea of second adolescence, of really feeling like they didn't get to have the experiences that their brother got to have or their sister or friends got to have, I'll say, yeah, like, yes, because of how our world's set up, so many of us don't get the adolescence that we see our straight peers getting to have, right? And so I'll do a lot of that kind of thing where it's kind of letting them more into my experience while also keeping it on them. And again, wanting to connect them to this greater collective experience that I think is so important. And so that's typically how self-disclosure works on my end. I haven't yet had someone come in because they're listeners to the podcast. And so that'll be a whole other journey to try to navigate. Like,
they already come in knowing you in some ways. They know your voice. They know your experience. They're familiar with you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the way that you know, part of the healing of shame is not feeling so alone. And so I can imagine how cathartic it is just to say, right, the we, the bigger we, but then also I know what that's like. I've been there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's
I find that clients really appreciate that kind of self-disclosure. Like, I know something about that feeling, or I've been there, or we, or even if you don't tell the story, just to know that they're not alone with an experience is very powerful.
Absolutely.
They should do more education on that in graduate school.
Absolutely. Well, also the more comfortable we are, whether that's in our identity or whether that's as therapists, the more flexible we become. Because I graduated from school and I had to kind of fit into my rigid interventions, models that I had been trained in. Right. And now I'm so much more myself in the room. And that's because I'm more comfortable with myself and I'm more comfortable with the work.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I can think back to like my first placement sites, like working in a middle school during my traineeship, like, and there was some queer students, and I was still at the beginning of my second adolescence in a lot of ways when I started grad school and beginning this whole journey. And I very much did not feel comfortable disclosing that part of me. Except there was one person I'm thinking about where I, and this has been a journey for me as well, is he was really struggling with his sexuality and wanting to come out, and was feeling just saying words that absolutely mirrored my younger self's experience. And I could feel my younger 12-year-old self in the room with me. And that younger self desperately wanted to be like, dude, me too. And have this moment. And I just I remember I processed it a lot in my own therapy and also with my supervisor of, I was starting to have a lot of that type of experience on my end as a therapist, that type of countertransference was coming up a lot, and having to really decipher what is some of my own stuff that I still need to work through, and then where is there that bonding point, where is that connecting point, where is it useful for me to disclose in order to support the client. So that took some time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's kind of the hardest part around self-disclosure and what you just shared, which is when you're going through it in the moment. Yeah, it's one thing to have gone through it and be on the other end. When you're in that thicket of it, it gets messy, and it gets really difficult to know when to disclose, when to relate, when to kind of feel dragged down into that place with them and have it hard to separate yourself. So it's great that you had that support around that.
I'm just curious, how much self-disclosure do you do on your podcast?
Yeah, I'd say definitely more than in therapy, which has also been this interesting journey. I feel so used to the dynamic of being a therapist in the room with someone versus kind of being the interviewer in the room with someone. And so that's been a growing edge for me and an evolution since I started the podcast, is learning how much of myself to bring in. There was still kind of this unconscious resistance to bringing myself in because of, I've always been trained through my work as a therapist to really keep a lot of myself out. And I also started the podcast because I wanted to highlight stories other than my own. I wanted to highlight the nuances of the queer experience and the nuances of second adolescence. And at the same time, I've also found there can be such a connecting point even with guests. And I feel like a lot of my story speaks to this collective experience as well. And so I've found much more comfort in self-disclosing there, because I also feel we're often talking on my podcast about some pretty tender topics, and there's such a joining that can happen between me and the guests in our shared queer experience. Like I mentioned before, how at the beginning of my career, I often felt my younger 12-year-old self with me whenever I was with a queer client. I really still feel that when I'm talking with people on the show. We're talking about their younger selves, my younger selves, and our little 14-year-old selves are right next to us and behind us. And I feel like they're getting to commune with each other and not feel alone anymore. And so I'll bring more of my experience in there, because it just also feels good to be able to connect. Yeah, it feels good.
It also sounds like there's something healing even in that process of just interviewing other people. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So when can we expect your book out?
That's a great question. So I'm at the silly point so the book's done, and I'm at the point where I'm exploring the right way to get out in the world, exploring kind of the self-publishing option, also exploring the traditional publishing option to work with an agent to make that happen. So I'm hoping to have things kind of get more solidified in the coming months, and I'll be hopefully announcing that sometime early 2023.
So exciting. Cool. And the book really kind of lays out kind of what you've been describing, what it is, your experience.
Yeah. So the book really uses my story as a way to illustrate what second adolescence is, kind of everything that we've been talking about in this conversation, everything from kind of what it's like for queer people growing up in the closet, what that coming out process is like, and what happens on the other side, these different kind of aspects of second adolescence and tasks of second adolescence. So really using my story to illustrate that concept for folks, while also kind of inviting people to be curious about their own experience along the way.
Oh, that'll be a really important book for a lot of people. Any resource, we always ask guests about any resources they would recommend, maybe resources for queer adults who are struggling and facing their second adolescence.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think the internet's complicated, but I also think there's so much great resources out there. I've had clients find so much power and benefit from even like going onto YouTube and hearing other people's coming out stories, their queer journeys, like just engaging with stories of other people, particularly if we're talking about clients who are feeling more isolated and alone in their experience and trying to navigate their comfort with their queerness. I also always recommend memoirs of queer people. Like, again, you can really get so much nuance when you get to read the words and hear the stories of folks. I love Cameron Esposito's Save Yourself, or Black Boy at a Time by Hari Ziad is a great book, learning, like unlearning anti-queerness and anti-blackness. Like, there's great resources out there. And then I think it, if the client's curious and open to this, like, so there's so many great support groups out there where you can meet with other queer people. And with the pandemic, a lot of these are now online and they're more accessible for folks, which is sometimes like people aren't ready for that. And so that's maybe something to kind of put on the back burner and keep, perhaps they need to do some more personal work to feel more comfortable with that. But I think it's such a great resource. And then, yeah, absolutely. I would invite people to come listen to Second Adolescence. We talk a lot about this. You'll hear from a lot of other people who've gone through the same experience. And it's such a cute little community we have where people are talking and sharing. And the goal of that community is to really help people feel less alone in their experience. So I'd love to invite as many people to come on over.
Mm-hmm. Great. And as a final question, are there any things that are inspiring you right now, just in general? Books, music, TV, film, whatever?
Okay, well, I guess this kind of ties into a little bit of Second Adolescence. The first thing I'm thinking about is, and I've been having a ton of conversations with queer friends, and also it's shown up a lot within the podcast community, is there's the show Heartstopper on Netflix, which is based on a graphic novel of the same. And it's basically this, like, that we have so much queer young adult content out there right now. And this is, Heartstopper is just a great show. For anyone going through their second adolescence, you gotta watch it, because it just shows this really tender queer adolescent romance that's happening today. And it's an experience that brings up, again, going back to grief, brings up a lot of grief for folks, because they're getting to have this experience of seeing this, both the show they wish they had access to and this experience they had access to, while also feeling a lot of joy that this is something that young people get to experience now. And I always recommend for queer adults to engage with queer young adult content and actively bring their younger self along for the ride with them, to have them get to have that experience too. Like, what is it like for them to get to see these like little adolescent queer youth getting to find love and getting to feel seen and getting to find joy? So that feels really exciting and inspiring to me. And it's been really cool to see other queer people have the same feelings around that. That's the first thing that comes to mind.
Yeah. I have to check that out. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. This has been so interesting, so helpful. And I've been referring clients to your podcast because I do think it is so helpful. And as you mentioned, like, some people who may not be ready to join a group, that the podcast is such a nice way just to be able to hear other people's stories and feel connected in a way that also feels safe for them. So it's been a real help.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you really so much for joining us. This was great and such good information.
Oh, I feel so honored to be here. I'm such a fan of LoveLink, and I think the conversations you host here are just so important. And so I just was so touched to be here, and I'm so touched. This was such a warm and yummy and cozy space that you both created. Like, for me, a product of my chronic shame that I'm still working through is there's still this resistance to taking up space and talking aloud, and which is like, why would I have a podcast? I don't know. But like, this is still very much a place where my younger self gets very nervous. And I just want to just name that I feel very appreciative to you both for just creating just such a lovely place to come talk about this.